Howdy. You know, I think it was like a year or two ago, there was one point where I was, I think it was early when we started using more of the sermon slides, and I started bringing up that I had taught math when I was a teacher for a while there, and I was showing something that was up on the slides and talking about teaching math, and some of the teachers were like, you know, that was a really good point that you made. I'm really glad you did that. And everybody else is, don't teach us math. Oh, my word. So I promise I'm not going to go into too much detail today, but I have to point out that I did also teach physics. I know. And, you know, one of the things that was always funny, we would talk about stuff like light, okay, which, you know, you get to go around with flashlights and get to talk about it and show how the light can, like, spread out and everything else. And I'd like to, you know, teaching them that, show them that light gives off this energy in little packets called photons, pew, 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 just kind of hitting whatever they shine on. It's not just this smooth, continuous flow, but then I also have to tell them it's not just a particle going pew, 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 but instead it's also like a wave, and it spreads out, and it actually overlaps at different times. And if it were only a particle, you'd never see it going around a corner. It would never be able to spread out down a dark hallway. So much of what we need about light, it's not a particle, it's not a wave, it's both. And then that's when their faces would get that look, that mix of confusion and kind of quiet rebellion, you know, it's like, that doesn't make any sense and I'd really like to escape as much as possible, which is why I don't teach too much Hebrew during these sermons. And they were right in a way. It doesn't make sense, at least not by the categories that we're used to. But just because it doesn't make sense, it doesn't change that it's still true. It works. Light is both a particle and a wave. It's not one or the other. It's both. And I remember realizing something about that moment. When something doesn't make sense, most people don't say, if it's true, I'll try to understand it. Instead, they say, I don't understand it, so maybe it's just not true. You know, I saw this again later whenever we were talking about the theory of relativity, the idea that time and space would change when you get close to the speed of light. And what I decided to do is, you know, I gave them an assignment, and I said, this has been proven to be true. What do you think? Do you believe it? And what was funny is that half of them said that even though there was evidence toward it, because it didn't make any sense, they were pretty sure it wasn't true. And I think we never quite grow out of that. We're more comfortable deciding whether something feels right than asking whether it is right. When something about God doesn't make sense to us, when he doesn't act the way we expect, or when his plan doesn't fit our categories, our first instinct is to stop trusting him as much. We're not looking at saying, well, maybe I just need to lean in. Instead, maybe we question whether or not his plans are real for our life. We start questioning whether he has genuinely seen us as his children. But God, like light, doesn't fit inside the boxes that we make for him. He's not controlled or contained by our understanding. He simply is. God acts. He moves. He reveals himself. And just because we can't fully explain him doesn't mean that he isn't there. It just means that he's greater than what our minds can hold. And that's the tension that Moses is encountering in Exodus 3. See, you got to remember who Moses was at this time. He's not out searching for a miracle. He was just out there doing his job. He was just an everyday person, tending sheep, living his life, raising a family. The excitement of Egypt, the way that he'd grown up, everything there, that was long behind him. Whatever dreams that he once had of making a difference for the Hebrew people, they were buried underneath the routines of survival, just taking care of business every day. And that's when God decides to speak to him. Why now? Out of nowhere, in the middle of an ordinary day, the divine just breaks in. And it's important to remember that Moses never really fit anywhere. He didn't fit in Egypt because he was a Hebrew. But he didn't fit among the Hebrews because he grew up in Pharaoh's palace. And then he, after killing the Egyptian, he didn't fit anywhere at all because he was a fugitive, a man living with his regrets. Yet, for whatever reason, that is the man that God calls. Not when Moses has his life together, but rather when he's just simply tending someone else's flock out in the wilderness. So when Moses hears God's voice, he's understandably hesitant. He wants to know how this could possibly work. Why anyone would listen to him of all people? What if they don't believe me? What if they ask who sent me? He's not just asking for the name of God. He's asking for reassurance, for something solid to stand on. And what God gives him is not a formula or a strategy. It's a name. I am who I am. It's a name that means both presence and promise. It's as if God is saying, I will be who I will be. I will do what I will do. My being is not dependent on your understanding or your comfort. For a man who had never quite belonged, it's an invitation into something larger than belonging. It's participating in the living purpose of God himself. And remember, Moses probably didn't know the traditions or the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob the way that the other Hebrews did. When God tells him, I am the God of your fathers, who? He's not just giving Moses words to say. He's giving him a connection now to a history that he never truly felt part of. He's being drawn back into the story of his own people through revelation. It's no wonder he brought together all of the stories of Genesis, not just for the rest of the people, but also for himself. But here's the turning point. Even after seeing the burning bush, even after hearing the voice, Moses still has to decide whether to trust it. The people will have to do the same. Just like those students who had to decide whether to believe in relativity once it became beyond what made sense, Moses has to decide whether to trust God beyond what felt comfortable. Because in the end, faith is not just about what we can explain. It's about who we trust when the truth is bigger than what we can grasp. But the same theme, it continues in Luke 20. You know those times whenever somebody is asking a question and you know that there's something behind it? You're kind of like, why are you asking me that? It's like, instead of it being just a regular question, you know that somehow they're trying to trick you a little bit. Or whenever somebody says and shows, hey, we're just having an open debate, but you know that they're actually just setting you up to try to make you look stupid. See, the Sadducees, they come to Jesus not with an honest question, but with a test. They don't believe in the resurrection, so they come up with this example that's meant to sound absurd. It's not seven brides for seven brothers, it's one bride for seven brothers. And they tell this story about a woman who marries seven brothers one after another because each of them dies without leaving a child. So Jesus, they ask in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? That woman, at moments, like, I don't know. She seems kind of scary. But it's important to realize that their question, it's not really about marriage. It's about control. The Sadducees are trying to control the conversation, to expose what they think is the ridiculousness of the resurrection. See, the details of marriage and inheritance, those are just props in the argument. Those are just attempts at trying to bring up something that doesn't make any sense. And when Jesus says that in the resurrection, people neither marry nor are given in marriage, The point is not dismissing marriage or saying that relationships won't matter. It's not as if in heaven, in the afterlife, if you ever run into your spouse, you're supposed to be like, stay away, I'm not supposed to have anything to do with you anymore. I mean, come on, you married them for a reason, right? But what he's focusing on is talking about how the systems of this world, the legal, the social, even the religious, they don't carry the same meaning in the age to come. Marrying, which would be in their context the man's initiative, and being given in marriage, which from their place was the woman's legal status, they were both parts of a world that were defined by property and inheritance and what happens when you die. But in the resurrection, those old structures, they don't apply, because death itself no longer defines what's possible. You're not looking to try to have kids in order to propagate your inheritance, because you're not dying ever again anyway. But what's fascinating, though, is that even within the story that the Sadducees tell, their logic falls apart. If anyone was technically her husband, it would have been the first one, because all the others were only fulfilling their duty to raise up children for him. But notice, Jesus doesn't even bother untangling their details. He doesn't care. He moves straight to the heart of the matter. What's the real issue? He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And of course, Jesus doesn't just say that. He proves it. His own resurrection does not just blow a hole in the Sadducees' logic. It blows open the limits of what anyone thought was possible. The resurrection is not just a theological rebuttal. It's the living evidence that God is not bound by death, time, the categories we use to make sense of life. The Sadducees, they wanted to keep faith neatly divided into this life or the next. What we can see or what we can't. Human power or divine promise. Let's stop thinking about the afterlife, because what we really need to focus on is how you live today. But in Jesus, those false boundaries, they collapse. The resurrection, it reveals God is not setting up a choice between caring for this world or caring for the next. Instead, he's redeeming both. Life now and life eternal are not two competing realities, but one continuous story held together by the living God. When Jesus rose from the grave, he didn't just conquer death. He connected heaven and earth, showing that God's power doesn't wait until the end of time. It begins now, in every act of trust, every step of faith, every moment we dare to believe that what's impossible for us is still possible for him. See, the real issue here, it was not marriage, it was the mindset. The Sadducees couldn't imagine a world that operated beyond their categories of life and death, marriage and inheritance, control and power. So since they didn't understand it, they mocked it. They mocked what they couldn't control. They rejected what they couldn't explain. And we do the same thing all the time. We create our own little Sadducee scenarios. We come up with extreme examples and ridiculous comparisons to make our point, or to justify what makes us comfortable. I can't talk about this with my spouse, or it'll be the end of the world if I do. I can't tell my child no. I mean, they're just going to throw a fit and think that I don't love them. I can't welcome these people into my life because someone might think that I approve of everything they've done. I better not be nice to them. We frame our choices in these false dichotomies, either or, all or nothing, right or ruined. But when we do that, we're doing exactly what the Sadducees did. We're trying to trap truth inside these boundaries that make us comfortable. The resurrection, like the burning bush, it's God's declaration that he cannot be trapped. He will be who he will be. He will work in his own way and in his own time. And our part is not to reduce his mystery into what feels safe or sensible, but to trust him enough to take the next faithful step, even when we don't quite see the whole picture yet. Because when we do, we often discover that God's reality is larger, richer, more alive than anything we could have imagined. So what do we do with all this? Because honestly, we're not all that different from Moses or from the Sadducees. I mean, like Moses, we often feel inadequate, uncertain, unqualified for what God calls us to do. We look around and think, who am I to speak? Who am I to lead? Who am I to believe that God could use me? And God's response is the same one he gave Moses. I will be who I will be. Not you will be enough. I will. God's promise isn't that you'll have it all figured out. It's that he'll be with you even when you don't. And like the Sadducees, we often let our discomfort masquerade as logic. When something doesn't fit into our categories in our mind, we logic it away as unrealistic or unreasonable. When God's ways don't fit our expectations, we treat them as if they couldn't possibly be true. But faith is not about explaining mystery. It's about walking within it. When we stop chasing the comfort of our tidy answers, then something begins to shift in us. We start to notice how much of our decision-making is so shaped by what's convenient or rather than what's always faithful. How many of our decisions that we've made were just the things that seemed normal or safe, instead of asking, is this really what God wants me to do? We begin to see how easily we settle for what other people tell us is reasonable, instead of asking what God is actually saying. Sometimes waiting on God means stepping back from the quick answers or the quick fixes or the ready-made plans that someone else promised as certainty, but drain our faith. It might mean refusing to rush into the next opportunity just because it looks certain and secure. It might mean pausing before you send that message, before you sign that paper, before you take that job, and asking God, where are you in this? Because waiting on God, it doesn't mean you're doing nothing. It means doing the slow, deliberate work of listening. The kind of listening that makes room for God's timing instead of forcing our own. It means learning to sit in the tension between the promise and the fulfillment without trying to fill that silence with our own noise. And often that's where God begins to move, in the waiting. He reshapes what we desire. In the waiting, he reshapes us. He teaches us to trust him, not only for outcomes, but for direction. He teaches us to trust him because he exposes where we've been relying on approval, control, comparison, and he replaces those things with something far sturdier, his presence. Because when you stop taking what the world offers as good enough, you make space for what is truly good, the presence of the I Am, who does not need your timeline or your plan to keep his promises. And in that stillness, when you stop trying to force God into your categories and instead wait on him to reveal himself, you begin to see glimpses of his nature. Mysterious, steady, radiant, light itself. Because you can't fully describe what light may be as a wave or a particle or both. Because the moment you try to fit it into a box, it means you stop understanding what it really is. But in much the same way, we try to force God into what makes sense to us. And we stop seeing who he really is. Because God does not need to be simple in order to be good. He doesn't need to fit our plans in order to be faithful. He just is. So the invitation to you today is this. Trust the I Am more than your I understand. Let go of the need to have it all make sense before you just say yes to him. Let God reveal in his own way and time what you cannot yet see. Because when you do, you'll start to notice something. The bush still burns. The voice still calls. And the resurrection still happens. Because we see it in what Christ Jesus has done himself for us. And when it does, real life begins again. Thanks be to God.